Hey, welcome, everybody. My name is Christina Rowe, and I am the publisher of Addiction 911 Magazine. And I'm here today with Debbie Sherrick, who is the editor of Addiction 911 Magazine, and she's also a codependency coach. And today we're going to be talking about the five ways to empower, not enable, an addict. And Debbie is an expert in codependency. So I would like Debbie to begin by telling her story. She's a very personal story dealing with an ex-spouse who is an addict. Debbie, can you tell us about what you went through?
Well, actually, I grew up in a very dysfunctional, alcoholic, domestic, violent home. So that was my beginning of learning about addiction. And then, of course, I continued. I was the oldest of four children, and I was the hero codependent of the family. I was the rescuer and the enabler of my siblings and my mother. My other three siblings ended up getting into addiction. I was the one that was always rescuing them and enabling them and doing it also with my father. So I know a lot about this topic today, about enabling and rescuing addicts. Through a lot of years, you know, it was like 30 years ago that I really got into my recovery and looking at my ACOA, my adult children of alcoholic issues of my childhood. And of course, I repeated, as we do, I married an addict who was also an abuser. And I have to say, though, that today I always give him gratitude. I'm grateful for him because he was my biggest messenger, the most painful relationship I've ever been in. And yet he taught me things that I needed to do to become empowered, to stop enabling, to stop rescuing, to stop trying to fix the addict. And it was through that marriage, a very painful marriage of 7 years where he was in and out. I think he was in about six treatment centers in 7 years. When we met, he had been in recovery 2.5 years. And of course, I thought he was fixed. But he, shortly after we married, he relapsed. I did end up divorced as I got healthier and he didn't. I did end up divorcing him. I had four children, small children. And I just had gotten enough therapy where I was setting boundaries. I was learning the tools of detaching and boundaries and focusing on myself and taking care of my own health and my own program that I got strong enough where I was able to divorce him. And he... Gee, that was many years ago. 15 years ago, he continued in his addiction after we divorced. And then 15 years ago, he did end up overdosing and dying from a heroin addiction. So that's kind of in a nutshell, quick synopsis of mine. And then, of course, I had a sister who died 4 years ago from meth overdose. An alcohol overdose. I have a brother who has been in and out of treatment with cocaine and crack. And he has actually been in recovery now for almost 6 years. And I have a sister who is in recovery as an alcoholic. She's just celebrated her ninth year. So all of us siblings that are alive now are in, healthy and recovery, have worked on our stuff. And so I know quite a bit about addiction and enabling and rescuing and what that looks like and what not to do.
You actually lived it, over again with different family members. And that seems to be a pattern with people who have either an addicted boyfriend or girlfriend. It seems to be a pattern that was in their family, right? Would you say like one of their parents was an addict and then they become either an addict themselves or they become an enabler, which was your case, you became the enabler. And, and that's a really hard position. I know you say something, Debbie, about enabling, that the enabler is just as sick as the addict. I've heard you say that before. Can you explain?
Yes. I'm glad you brought that up. I can remember when I went to my first therapy session in 1987, my husband had first relapsed. And I found she was just an angel. She was just a fabulous codependency coach. And she said to me when I first went in, I said, I'm here. My husband has relapsed. And I'm here because I want to know, I want you to teach me what I need to do to get him to quit using. That's what I said. And she looked at me and she said, well, first I want to ask you a question. She said, do you know what codependency is? And I said, well, I've heard of it. And she said, were any of your parents addicts or alcoholics? I said, my father was an alcoholic. And she said, Debbie, do you realize that you're just as sick as your addict husband? And I said, what? I was so offended when she said that to me, because I felt that I was the responsible one. I was taking care of the home, the bills. You know, I was holding everything together as a good codependent does. I was being so overly responsible for him and the family and everything that I didn't see myself as sick. I thought I was the healthy one and that I was married to a sick person. So yes, it's true. And, you know, Christina, when I go and talk at treatment centers or speak to groups of the families who have addicts, they're in recovery or they're wanting, one of the first things I do is I ask them, please raise your hand if you are in some type of recovery yourself or in therapy about your, you know, to handle your addict or to work on it. And, you know, very few people raise their hand because they feel that if the addict will just quit using and get better, then everything will be okay. So I'm a big advocate about the whole family being in recovery and that when you are involved and have an addict that you love, whether it's a spouse or a child or an aunt or not, whatever, it's important for you to understand the disease and for you to understand your role in it and the dance that you do with the addict. And after I started began my journey, she started me on going to ACOA meetings every week. And when I started going to those, I felt like I was at home, that they were reading my mail, all the feelings that I had, how I grew up, how I looked at relationships. Everyone in there was speaking my language. And it was like an answer to me of all the anxiety and depression and anger and fear of abandonment and shame and all those things that I had felt all my life, that I knew I finally found the reason why. I do encourage people that are with addicts to work on themselves and, have some detachment from the addiction and start looking at their role in it because we can keep the addicts using.
Right.
You know, a good codependent can really enable the addict to continue to loot, to use. And I feel personally that's what happened with my ex-husband. He came from a very wealthy family and his family was very prominent in Palm Beach and they did not want anyone to know, you know, to ruin their image that he was this addict. And so they put on this front that, you know, wasn't going on. They kept it a secret. And I wanted to have interventions. I wanted to really, you know, he never really hit a bottom. He never really had consequences. He was so enabled. And I used to say to them, you're going to enable him to death. You're going to love him to death. And because he would go out using and spend thousands of dollars and go right back to work with his father and never have any consequences. And he never really hit a bottom. I was able, you know, to hit a bottom. Times that he went to treatment, he was Baker's acted or we forced it or, you know, he would like hit a bottom for a little bit, but then he wouldn't stay in recovery. So enabling can really, we have to really look at that because if you're really wanting your addict and to get healthy, it's very important that you look at your enabling and what you're doing to help them stay in addiction.
So what would you say would be, we're going to talk about the five ways to empower and not enable an addict. Let's talk about some of those ways. What would be, you know, I mean, people, I don't know, like, let me check it on the comments here. Has anybody here right now in a situation where you feel like you're enabling the addict in your life? If you are, you can just put a comment here in the box. Also, I just want to mention, if you want to go over here to the left and just say, tell a little bird and share us on Twitter. And of course, make sure to follow. We follow back. So follow both Debbie and I, and we will definitely follow you back. So Debbie, let's just start with one of the five ways that, you know, people tend to enable instead of empowering. How can we switch that around? Like, say a mother's got a child, and that's probably one of the hardest ones.
That is one of the hardest ones. Yeah. I would probably say that's probably half my clientele that I see are mothers or fathers that parents who have adult children at home that are using. And it's a really difficult situation. I do believe that it is tougher to stop the rescue and enabling when it's a child than if it was a spouse or a brother. You know, it's really tough, especially on the moms, because we're born nurturers. We're born to take care of our children, and we're born to, you know, when our kids are hurting or in trouble, the mom, you know, it's just born within us. It's our intuitive nature to want to take care and help our children. So when it comes to addiction and you have an adult child in the home, I actually love working with parents like that, because it's very rewarding to set boundaries. You know, first I kind of work with them on how they can detach from the addiction. It all depends on how enmeshed they are with the addict, because we lose our identity and their addiction. And really the addict is the one who he is the role. He runs the home.
Right.
Because everyone's watching the addict. And, you know, if the addict's sad, we're sad. If the addict's happy, we're happy. If they're using, we're depressed. You know, they run the temperature of the home. So first, you know, really finding out how enmeshed are you with the addict? You know, how much do you focus on them? Do you watch what they're doing? How much do you police them? How much do you try to get them to get it and talk to them about their problem? How much do you argue with them, fight with them, threaten with them? How much energy of your life are you putting into the addict? And so once, you know, we kind of gauge that and see what the activity is, you know, with them and how enmeshed they are, I think one of the first things, important things to do is to start teaching them and giving them some tools of how to pull away, how to detach and get the focus on themselves. Because really a codependent, when they, at first, they don't really know how they're feeling or what's going on inside them. Their GPS system is not about them. Their GPS is about the addict. We know everything they're doing, they're thinking, they're, you know, their next move, what's in their head. I mean, we're just so upset. That's really our addiction, is the addict. And so, yeah, trying to get them to focus on themselves and look at themselves. What is their responsibility? You know, how are they keeping this going? How can they pull away and detach a little bit? So I think detachment is one that is something that's good.
You talk about detachment, Debbie, what would be, let's say, an example of detachment? Let's say a mother has, you know, a 15-year-old son who's, you know, she's caught doing drugs. And what would her first step to detachment be?
Well, I think one thing would be in detaching is emotionally. I think first we have to learn to detach emotionally. And sometimes in first learning to detach, we have to detach in anger. You know, we're mad. We're mad, you know, that this is continuing. We're mad at the addiction. I think also teaching people to separate the person from the addiction, you know, that you don't want to enable the addiction. Yes, you love your son, but the addiction is ruling and running your son right now. So because they're just looking at their son as their beautiful son, you know, their little boy, their beautiful little boy. And of course, you know, we love that. But when they are in their addiction, that's what we need to get angry about, is the addiction and how it is controlling our lives and affecting our lives. So I think first detaching emotionally and not reacting, not overreacting, because there is that dance in the home that's going on, that the addict is doing something or not coming home or not obeying the rules. And we trigger and we react and we go off and rage and threaten and do this and do that. And so trying to get them a little more grounded in detaching their emotions and giving them strategies. How do they do that? You know, how do I detach emotionally? from this person that I'm not a wreck. Because most of them, when they are enablers and really wrapped up and enmeshed in an addict, they are a nervous, stressful wreck. Right. You know, their anxiety levels are high. They're not sleeping well. They're depressed. They're nervous. And so, you know, it's all up to me as a holistic coach. I work with them physically, too, with their body and what's going on and doing some energy work and maybe some supplements to help calm their nervous system because they're a wreck. So you got to kind of get them calmed and detached from the situation a little bit, focused on that. And then the next step I feel with after the detaching emotionally, part of the detaching is learning how to set boundaries because enablers have no boundaries with the addict.
Right, because they every time the addict, you know, threatens and says, you know, if you don't give me money, I'm, you know, I'm going to go out and, you know, whatever they're going to do, you know, the enabler winds up being controlled by the addict.
Yes. And, you know, addiction, part of the disease of addiction is manipulation. I mean, they are pros at manipulating the enablers. They know what buttons to push. They know how to get us to help them. You know, it is just part of the addiction. You know, the tears, the begging, the crying, and it's very hard, especially as a parent, to know whether this child is telling the truth and really hurting and really wants help, or, you know, or they're just, it's the disease manipulating.
So it makes it really tough to set boundaries. So how does a mother or, you know, a spouse, how do they set that with somebody that they obviously, you know, they love tremendously? How do you do that tough love? How do you set those boundaries?
Well, if it's a child living in the home, I love contracts with an addict child, adult child. I love them. They work. If they're enforced, I encourage them. And so I will work with the parent. And the thing is about a contract, if both parents are in the house, both parents really need to be on board with this contract. They need to be backing each other. They need to be supporting each other. And so we work together. The contract is about boundaries because, you know, you hear parents say, well, you know, they're using, you know, I see the paraphernalia in their bedroom. I see their eyes, see how they're acting, you know, but I can't get them out of my house. You know, they really feel like they're powerless. And so I'll say to them, listen, this is your home and these are your rules. And they'll say, but I tell him that and he doesn't listen. And so that's where a contract comes in, where, you know, specifically we sit down and do boundaries of what they want to implement in their home. You know, what doesn't feel good to them? What's not okay with them? And of course, one of the boundaries is drug use. And I encourage drug testing. You know, if you have an adult child in the home and you're doing a contract with them, definitely need to be drug tested, you know, every so often, however we set that up. And also, if it's a teenager, you know, the curfew, there needs to be curfews. There needs to be that because it's their home, they're paying the mortgage, they're paying all the bills. They need to be able to go in and into that room and be able to go through everything in that room. Because the child has broken trust. And so, you know, the child will say, well, this stay out of my room. This is my stuff. No, you've been using drugs. This is my home. You're privileged to stay here right now. So I get to go in your bedroom and your drawer, and I get to check everything in your room to make sure there's no paraphernalia in there. So those are some of the, you know, some of the things we put in the contract, you know, and then the boundary is, you know, they write the rules of the home, and then we work up a thing where if any of these rules are broken, that they have 2 weeks to get out of the home, a week to get out of the home, whatever the situation is, we set that up, that they, if they, because they're going to sign the contract too. The parents sign the contract, the addict signs the contract. And if they won't sign the contract, you know, it's just like, you know, part of not enabling is allowing the addict to have consequences and learn about real life. I mean, all of us in life, every choice we make has a consequence, whether good or bad.
Right.
And when you're enabling an addict and the caretaker and enabling and rescuing, you prevent them from having consequences. And therefore, they stay emotionally very immature. They don't learn to grow up because life is about having consequences.
Right.
And so, you know, if we're, you know, learning about life on an adult level, if you're getting an apartment or you're moving into a home, you have to sign a contract of rules of, you know, if I'm renting this place, this is how I have to live. You know, I have to pay there. I have to act like this. So because they've broken trust, they must sign the contract in order to stay there, you know, in order to be able to live there. And then the hard part is getting the parents, if the contract is broken, to follow through.
Yeah, that has to be the most difficult time. How do you actually, you know, throw your child out on the street knowing?
But you got to have a plan. Yeah, you have to have a plan. Depend, you know, again, this depends on the age of the child. You know, sometimes it may not be that you're throwing them out. Sometimes it might be that if they break the contract, that they must go into a treatment program.
And if they refuse, what happens when you get an addict that just refuses all cooperation?
Well, I've had parents who have told the child, you know, call a friend, call someone, and have boxed up their clothes and put them in the front yard and said, you have 24 hours to come get your things. And it is tough. And during that time, it's very important that they have support system. You know, they need to have people supporting them, helping them through this because of the backlash. You know, there's always backlash when we set boundaries.
Right.
You know, you can count on it because you're changing the system. You're changing the dance. You know, they're not able to manipulate you anymore. They're, you know, they're seeing that they're losing ground. They're losing their enabler. And let me tell you something, addicts, when they're not ready to stop using, they find another enabler. It's amazing. They can always find somebody to come pick them up, somewhere to land, somewhere. There are many codependents out there who are willing to enable, you know, our children or an addict. And, you know, I also want to give props since we're talking about mothers and addicts to Sandy Swenson and the book that she wrote. You know, I interviewed her on Empower Hour show. It was great. She wrote the book, The Joey Song.
Right.
And that's about her son. And she's a mother who went through all of this enabling and rescuing, you know, in with her son, and how she went through the steps to finally learn to stop enabling him and rescuing him and take her hands off of him. And, she's up north. I forget where she lives, but he's still down here. You know, he's been in and out of treatment and still not in recovery, but yet she is such a supporting advocate. And that book is fabulous for any parent who has a child who is an addict.
It's that's very on Amazon, right? The Joey Song by
Joey Song. Yes, it's on Amazon. Yeah.
Get up on Amazon. And she's excellent. We had an article from her also for the Addiction 911 magazine.
Yes. That's right.
Read that. If you want to pick up a free copy of Addiction 911 magazine, just go to that URL, addiction911magazine.com. You could read it in PDF. It's available on the iPad. We just got approved for iPhone, which is good news. and we're also on Google Play and Android. So I think we're on all the devices right now. So you could download it right on any phone, Addiction 911 magazine. And we have got Debbie has some fantastic articles in there as well, some other really great contributors, as well as Sandy, who's contributed some really great material for us. So I just wanted to give her that shout out. But so now let's switch gears a little bit, Debbie. So now you've got, you know, we're talking about a mother with a child. What about a spouse with a child? It's a little, you can't really put a contract with your husband or wife, or can you? It's a little bit different, right?
Yes. Yes. Usually when it's a spouse, the most important thing is, you know, to learn, you know, we tend to be in denial as codependents, thinking that we're going to be able to fix them. We're going to be able to get them to stop using, you know, if we do this right, if we change this, if we get rid of their, pour the alcohol out, if we follow them, if we check their pockets, you know, all the things that we do to try to get our spouse, you know, the fighting and things like that. So I think when it's a spouse, the most important thing is to get them to get their eyes totally off their spouse and get it on themselves and start working on their program. They need to learn to get healthy, get empowered, learn about boundaries, learn about detaching, learn about self-love, see what they're doing to enable, you know, we all have different ways that we enable. And I think it's important that they look at, you know, and list, you know, how do I enable, you know, what do I need to stop doing? And that all takes time because it's such familiar, scary to stop, you know, trying to fix the addict. I can remember, when I was in, first started my recovery, and my codependency coach said to me, because I would, when my husband would stay out all night late using, or sometimes all night using, the next day he'd be passed out in the bed, and I would like go through his pockets, look at his shirt, smell his clothes, find numbers. I mean, I was just obsessed with knowing where he was, who he was with, how much money he spent. You know, and sometimes I would even get in the car and try to find him. You know, it's just like it truly is the adrenaline rush is like an addiction of obsession to try to find and fix the addict. And so when she said to me, all right, you're going to stop all of that. No more going through the pockets. No more getting in the car looking for him. No more trying to call him. No more nothing. You're going to totally stop and put your focus on you. And she said, let me ask you something too, because I am a person of prayer. And she said, how much time are you spending praying for him? I said, almost all my, I pray, you know, about an hour a day for him. I mean, I'm always praying for his addiction. I'm always praying for him. She goes, I even want you to stop that. She goes, just say, God, I just give you David today. Then I want you to focus praying on for yourself, praying for God to show you and help you. And she said, because you're even being codependent about your, in your prayer time, you know, you're totally obsessed with him. So, I'll tell you, when I had to stop doing those things, it was like I was going through withdrawal. I just lost you, Christina. I think, yeah, I don't, I think I'm still on. I'm going to keep talking. So, when I stopped doing all those things, I went through withdrawal. I mean, it was very hard for me to take my focus off the addict and put it on myself. I didn't know how to do that. I really did not know how to look at myself. I didn't know how to do those things. So, it's a tough process, you know, learning when those behaviors are so familiar to us. So when we're talking about today, we're talking about enabling, we're talking about rescuing the addict and how we stop doing that. So I was sharing how in my journey and my story of how I had to learn to stop doing the enabling that I was doing. One of the things, would be my husband would call me in the night to come get him somewhere. And I would get in my car and go get him. And so that's one thing that I stopped doing. He would call, I would say, no, I'm not coming to get you. And I would hang up. I took all of the money and put it in a different account. And I didn't give him an ATM card, things like that, because he was draining the account. So I started taking control back of my life and stopped giving him all the power and all the control. It was hard. It was scary, but oh gosh, it was so worth it to take my power back and not let the addict control the home anymore. So I think really what's important is for you all to ask yourself, you know, how do you enable? You know, are you always giving money to the addict? Are you always rescuing the addict? Do they not have consequences? Are you always giving them chance after chance after chance after chance after chance with no boundaries in the relationship? So ask yourself that. And I also encourage that you can't do it alone. You know, get you support, go to meetings, get a therapist, work with me as a codependency coach. And I work with people nationally. You know, I do Zoom so I can screen share and show them documents and homework and things. I give a lot of tools working with people in their enabling and their rescuing of their addict. So you really need to have support. When you are doing these things, when you're trying to stop enabling, when you're trying to detach, you're trying to set boundaries, you're trying to learn about yourself and get your strength back. Hi, Christine, are you back on?
Yes. Can you see me now? I'm sorry.
You can. That's okay. I just kept talking.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you.
Okay. I don't see you now, though.
You don't see me?
No. Okay. I hear you.
You
but
hear
I don't
me.
See you.
Okay. This is really strange. I've seen myself on the camera here.
That's okay. Just keep talking. You have any other questions?
Yeah. What did I want to ask you? Okay. So I missed about, because when I got off, I got cut off from the internet. I missed a couple of things you might have said. So why don't you just continue on? And as you're talking, then I'll jump in.
Okay. Well, I was just talking about how important it is if you are do have an addict in your life and you are enabling that person, how important it is to have support, to get into meetings, to go, you know, have a coach, have a therapist, have a support group. If you cannot do it by yourself, because you will fall back into that old behavior. And I know that the results in getting healthy and detaching and stopping enabling the addict all comes from us learning to love ourselves, learning to really focusing on ourselves, learning to ask, why am I rescuing this person? Why can I not set boundaries? Why do I continue to give money or go pick this person up from jail or not allow them to have consequences? You know, here's the thing about codependency, Christina, that we need to understand. All this comes really from the root from our childhood. And it doesn't mean that we have to grow up in a home with addiction. There's a lot of different dysfunctions, you know, that we can grow up in. But we codependents, you know, have a root of they need to be needed, and they get need and love confused. So they feel that if someone needs them and they're able to rescue them and take care of them, it boosts their self-esteem. It makes you feel loved. It makes you feel needed. And so the more they can rescue, the more they can enable, the more they can help, then they feel better about themselves. The problem with that is that, you know, that's looking for love on the outside and trying to use things and people on the outside to fill you on the inside. And that's why, you know, I named my business Inside Out Wellness, because it is about doing that inside work. You have to learn about the inside, what's going on the inside of you. Why do you not have self-love and self-esteem? Why do you come from a root of shame and feeling not good enough? Why do you need people to need you, being overly responsible? You know, I always say codependents are the most loving people on the earth, you know, but we don't have a boundary with that. We love where we are the ones that are constantly giving and enabling and rescuing, and we're over here not getting our needs met.
Right.
And because we actually don't feel worthy, have the confidence to think our needs are important. And I think one of the most profound things to know when we really get it in our head, because codependents tend to be victim, you know, they blame and look what he's doing to me and look how he's made me feel and look what he's putting me through. And one of the most profound things to learn is that we teach people how to treat us by what we allow. We are responsible for how people are treating us. We are responsible for what's going on in our life because we allow it and we've had weak boundaries. So when we know that and we really learn that, it takes away the victim part, because no one can treat us in any way or make us feel in any way unless we allow it ourselves.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
It really is. It's that we allow it, and it's learned behavior from childhood, and yeah. You know, that'll attract you more. If you were fixing a parent, you're going to be attracted to addicts growing up. And I think that's a really good point. So I think the number one way to actually empower an addict is to empower yourself.
Absolutely.
Put the focus back on yourself. Mm-hmm. And look at yourself and be able, you know, start working on that instead of the addict, because it's a reflection of what's going on.
Actually, it's actually a gift that you can give the addict. If you can think of, you know, I'm going to work on myself and I'm going to put as much energy, and this is what I share with clients. I want you to focus and put as much energy on yourself right now. And I say, I give you permission to be selfish right now, because it's an act of self-love for you right now. So I want you to use as much energy as you've been using on the addict and paying attention to the addict and enabling the addict. I want you to take that energy and put it on yourself right now.
Wow.
You're going to focus on you. Put it on you. You're going to take care of you one day at a time and do what's best for you each day. So it's a gift to the addict, because they need us to stop enabling. They need us to stop rescuing them, because they need to face their addiction. They need to face themselves. They need to hit a bottom. They need to have all their enablers stripped from them.
And what are the consequences of not doing that? It's often, I hate to say this, but I've seen it personally with people who cannot stop enabling, that the addict winds up dying.
Yeah. Yes.
And unfortunately, that's if they never hit rock bottom and they're always, you know, being, you know, you're always like, I heard somebody in addiction once say, it's like you're always putting that pillow under their butt and not letting them fall to the, you know, hit the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And eventually it can lead, I mean, to them dying, because they never hit their rock bottom. And I think that's the only way, usually most addicts would say, hitting rock bottom is the way that they, you know, they recover.
Well, you know, they say, in the rooms, you either get healthy and work your program, go to jail, or you die. You know, those are the three choices with addiction. And so, you know, I think something else it's important to bring up about enabling is that what motivates a lot of us, the codependent behavior in enabling, is guilt. And it's the false guilt, you know, the guilt that if I don't rescue them, if I don't let them stay in my home, if I don't, you know, keep doing the things that I'm doing that I shouldn't be doing, then they're going to die.
Right.
And so we put that responsibility on ourselves, that I'll feel guilty. What if they go out there and they're living under a bridge? What if they, you know, end up dying? Then it's going to be my fault. You know, there's a joke in CODA rooms, and I heard it years ago, but it said, what kind of insurance do codependents buy? My fault. They think everything, oh, it's my fault. It's my fault if they relapse. It's my fault, you know, like I didn't do this, or I didn't take, you know. So when they start acting, yeah, they take on that responsibility of the addiction. And so, you know, tough love is real love. That's real love.
It's hard.
It's hard. Yeah. And it's not easy, but it works. It really works. I've seen it work over and over. And you can hear so many stories of addicts who will say, you know, if my mother or my wife, you know, wouldn't have let me hit this bottom, or I ended up doing this, you know, I wouldn't be in these rooms today. I wouldn't be in recovery. You hear that over and over again. My brother was like that. My mother was, she was the worst enabler. Well, her and I together, you know, picking him up from jail, I can't tell you how many times. And then when he would get in treatment, you know, we'd take him all this food and clothes and radio and a Bible. You know, we just were like, smothering him, and he always had us call to come pick him up. And then when I got into recovery and stopped doing those things, I'd say, you can't call me, I'm not coming to get you anymore. Then he worked on my mom, and finally my mother, I'm like, Mom, you know, he would come and knock on her door and just, you know, have been on the streets and say, you know, I need money for food. And, you know, she'd give him $25. And I'd say, Mom, you probably just bought him crack, you know,
wow.
Just buying crack. But when my mother stopped all of that, when she stopped it all, he ended up living under a bridge in Lake Worth. And I love hearing his story. He ended up homeless people beat him up, and he ended up, busted his spleen. He ended up going to Delray Community and having this emergency surgery and his spleen removed. And they took him from there to treatment. And that was almost 6 years ago. And he says today that he's so grateful that his mom and his sister stopped enabling him and let him. That was his bottom. That's what it took for him.
Right.
You know, he said, I think I'd still be on the streets if mom or my sisters were still, you know, helping me and giving me money. He really had to, you know, and everybody's bottom is different. You know, right. We don't know what it'll take for each person's bottom. But my ex-husband ended up dying, you know. However, he never did. He's a good example of having all the enablers.
Right. You remember you telling me that. Always enabled by his parents. His parents enabled him. So that's a really important thing for anybody listening today or going to watch this on the replay or listening on the podcast or, it's so hard. Believe me, me and Debbie, we feel for you. Debbie's lived it. I've been, in situations. I've had friends who enabled and watching it. And it's such a difficult, heart-wrenching experience. And you just have to know that if you do stop enabling and you do tough love, chances are you're going to have a much higher likelihood of your addict in your life surviving than not. Wouldn't you say if you can do that, if you can cut the tough love and do the tough love and cut the enabling out?
Yes. And the other thing is that you're going to feel better. You know, you're going to start feeling so good about yourself the more you feel good about yourself and build yourself up and start looking at your own life and start recovering yourself, it's easier to set boundaries and detach because you're feeling empowered. You've got support. You're feeling good about yourself. You're working on your own issues and you're getting healthier that you can then let go and let God to your addict. You can live and let live. You can live your life and let them live their life. I always tell clients too, if they have a loved one in recovery, you know, take your hands off their recovery, focus on your own. Don't police them that they're going to meetings or they're calling their sponsor or they're working their program. You know, take your hands off, live and let live, let them live their life, work their program and you work yours. Because it's so easy for us to get into that, you know, controlling, like step one for codependence. You know, I am powerless over my addict. I am powerless over people, places, and things. And we get that obsessed with that as the drug addict does with the drug or the alcoholic with booze.
Right. And it's an addiction in itself.
Yes, it can be. That's where you get your worth, you know, that you feel taking care of the needs and rescuing, you have this false belief that you're being a really good person.
Right. Exactly. Well, Debbie, this has been, I'm going to ask, just open it up. If anybody has any questions, I'll open up the seat for a minute. If you have a question, you want to jump in, please do now. Or if you want to write on, I'm looking through the comments here. I just want to see if we have any comments. I see that, TOK Mule said, I need to break an addiction. If you want to jump in and tell us about that, we're here to help. If anybody else wants to jump in, we'll just give that a minute. But, you know, some really, really great advice here from you, Debbie, that is so needed. You know, it's just, this is just an addiction is an epidemic that, rampage through the country. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible thing that's going on. So,
And it is a family disease. You know, the pain of the addict, the whole family's in pain. You know, the whole family is going through their part. And I think that's so important to stress. It's not just that the addict has an addiction. It spreads out into the family. And the whole family's in pain. The whole family's hurting. And so I just have such a... so much compassion and empathy for people going through that because I've lived it and I know the pain of it. I know the feeling of powerlessness that you just want to do something so bad and there's nothing you can do. And I know the feeling of walking on eggshells and fear, constant fear, waiting for the other shoe to drop all the time.
Right.
Even when they get in recovery and get out of treatment or in recovery, you're just wondering, are they going to relapse? It's a really painful, hard thing to go through. And I just want to encourage those that are involved in addictions and that have an addict to just get help. You know, yeah. Take the first step and get help and start working on yourself. And it's so worth it. It is just.
Well, Debbie, can you tell us how they can contact you? Because you do work with, you work personally with codependents.
Yeah, I was telling them that I do work nationally too with Zoom. But you can contact me on my website, insideoutwellnesscoach.com. I have a contact form there. You can email me at Debbie@insideoutwellnesscoach.com also. And I have a lot of support groups also on Facebook. I have a codependency page, and I also have some closed support groups with women for codependency. And then I have the Empower Hour show.
Right. Right. And we have this show now every Friday. I think it's going to be, we're going to be moving it a little earlier, probably 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Fridays. So yeah. We're going to be bringing on different guests and talking about addiction. And we're going to wrap this up now, but I want to thank everybody for joining us today. And also, you know, visit Debbie's websites and also go to addiction911magazine.com to get your free issues of the magazine. It's absolutely free. The downloads are free on the app. This way you can get the new issues. We produce the magazine 4 times a year. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much, everybody, today. I appreciate, thank you for dealing with all the technical difficulties that we went through today, too. All right. Appreciate you guys being on, and thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you, Tina. Have a great day.